headlines, a local Canadian tribe announces that it has found more than 160 undocumented and unmarked graves near a residential school site. The unrest in South Africa, which was triggered by the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma, intensifies despite the deployment of thousands of soldiers. And at least four people are killed in an explosion in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. A Canadian Indigenous community says it has found more than 160 undocumented and unmarked graves in an area home to a former Catholic residential school for Native children. The Penalakut tribe says that the graves were found in the southern Gulf Islands of the state of British Columbia. The grounds were home to Cooper School. The facility was part of a national plan that forced Indigenous families to send their children to Catholic boarding schools to be supposedly civilized. A series of unmarked mass graves containing remains of Indigenous kids have been found in Canada in the past several weeks. One contained bodies of more than 750 children. The discoveries have sparked outrage among the First Nation communities. They have called the practice cultural genocide. Political analyst Barry Grossman says that it is shocking to see the Canadian government has not taken any significant action over the discovery of mass graves at former church-run, Catholic-run schools for Indigenous children.
It's rather unfortunate that the government of young Justin Trudeau seems to be trying to have a bet both ways, that is, he admits that there's a problem here, but doesn't seem to be taking any significant action to make something happen. And in fact, for the most part, the establishment in Canada seems to be standing in the way of developments, bearing in mind that the Supreme Court of Canada ruled not so long ago that there's literally tens of thousands of documents that can be legally destroyed that are relevant to these issues. And there was a three-year-long inquiry running into this problem, which reached the conclusion that there was indeed a genocide that took place. There are a group of lawyers in Calgary, which is where I originally came from, that have combined together to call on an investigation by a UN special appointed tribunal at The Hague. But that hasn't gone very far. But more than anything else, I find it astounding that the authorities in Canada, including the RCMP and Parliament, have not commenced their own inquiries in order to get to the bottom of all of this, because these are numbers which are really too shocking for anybody to ignore based on some assumption that this was something from deep in Canada's historical past, and therefore the best way to deal with it is to get over it.
Moving on, authorities in South Africa have stepped up security in several provinces as the death toll from violence sparked by the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma rises to 45. President Cyril Ramaphosa has ordered the dispatch of troops to help police deal with the unrest and restore order. Stores in several cities were looted and vandalized for the fifth consecutive day. Nearly 760 people have so far been arrested by the police, with most of them in Johannesburg, South Africa's economic capital. On Monday, the Constitutional Court heard an application to review its decision to jail Zuma for a contempt of court. The court has reversed its judgment to a later but unspecified date. Zuma is sentenced to 15 months in jail for not appearing before a commission looking into graft scandals during his presidency. Fighters aligned with local leaders in Ethiopia's Tigray say that they have launched a new offensive in the northern region and seized a town, a major town actually, there. A spokesman for the Tigray fighters says they managed to clear the town of Raya from federal forces. He also said the fighters have seized control of the southern parts of Tigray. Clashes are also underway in the western parts of the region. Tigray has witnessed a deadly fighting between Ethiopian federal troops and local fighters since November. Thousands of people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced ever since. An explosion in the Afghan capital Kabul has killed at least 4 civilians and wounded 5 others. Earlier, our correspondent Amina Lemi gave us an update on the situation there.
According to Firdaus Faramaz, the spokesperson of Kabul Police Headquarters, the incident took place after this roadside bomb blast went up very close to traffic police checkpost in Sinamaya Pamir area of Maiwand Road. The current situation proves that not only the most secure areas in Afghanistan are facing widespread violence and fightings between Afghan security forces and the Taliban, but also the militants have taken control over some key border areas that connect Afghanistan to northern and western neighbors of Afghanistan, including Tajikistan and Iran.
The Taliban militant group says it does not want to engage in fighting inside Afghan cities. The Taliban made the announcement as it continues fighting with government forces in different areas of Afghanistan. The group also gave a warning to Turkey over its decision to extend troop presence in Afghanistan after U.S.-led forces fully leave next month. On Friday, Ankara announced that it had reached a conditional deal with Washington to continue guarding Afghanistan's international airport in Kabul. The Taliban called the decision ill-advised, reprehensible, and a violation of Afghanistan's territory. Now, Russia has warned the U.S. against redeploying its military forces from Afghanistan to neighboring Central Asian countries. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov says that the move is paramount of U.S. military presence and is unacceptable. He warned that such a scenario would greatly change not only Moscow's perception of regional developments, but also its relations with the U.S. Rybakov added that Russia had made its position perfectly clear to the Americans. Russia's foreign minister had also earlier stressed that the U.S. presence in Central Asian countries would not address regional security concerns. Sergei Lavrov said no regional country had allowed the deployment of U.S. forces pulled out of Afghanistan. Last month, President Joe Biden said after his withdrawal from Afghanistan, the U.S. would reorganize its, quote, counterterrorism capabilities and assets in the region. China says it is opposed to U.S. interference in its internal affairs, including over issues related to Hong Kong.
We have stated our position on the Hong Kong issue many times, and we oppose the U.S. interference in China's internal affairs through the Hong Kong issue. The Hong Kong Basic Law and related laws clearly protect the rights and interests of foreign investors.
Beijing's reaction followed a report that Washington is set to warn American companies of increasing risks of operating in Hong Kong. The report also claimed that U.S. companies face threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data of foreign firms and stores in Hong Kong. The development comes amid growing tensions between Beijing and Washington over a range of issues. The two top economies remain at odds over issues such as Hong Kong, Taiwan, and South China Sea, as well as trade and the emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic. Meanwhile, a fire has reportedly broken out following a blast at an oil refinery in the Israeli city of Ashdod. There are no official details of any damage or casualties yet. An Israeli journalist reported the blaze, saying that it was caused by an explosion. Israeli sources say the explosion caused fuel leaks at the refinery, and efforts are ongoing to address the problem. No further details have been released about the cause of the blast. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has released new footage showing the capture of two Israeli soldiers back in 2006. The release marks the anniversary of the incident, which then sparked the second Lebanon war. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has released new footage showing the capture of two Israeli soldiers back in 2006. The video shows Hezbollah troops firing at an Israeli vehicle carrying the two soldiers in order to stop it. They then arrest the soldiers and leave the scene. The footage was aired by a Lebanese channel owned and operated by Hezbollah. The release marks the anniversary of the incident which sparked the second Lebanon war in 2006. 2 years later, Hezbollah returned the bodies of both Israeli soldiers as part of a deal with Tel Aviv. Israel claims that they were killed at the moment of their capture, but Lebanon says that they lost their lives later on in Israeli bombardments. Joining us to discuss this further, Saeed Shahabi is a political activist, journalist, and commentator who joins us from London, and we also have Mohsen Saleh, who's an academic and lecturer, joining us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. Mohsen Saleh, let me first start with you. When you take a look at this war, it still has ramifications in terms of what it really meant. And when you assess the time period from the year 2006 up to this point, who do you think it has advanced more in terms of capabilities, Israel or Hezbollah, when you put the whole picture together here?
Well, hi to you and to the audiences. I guess this operation opened and paved the way for the resistance to become a difficult and a very strong element and a group in this region, in the Arab region, until the Israelis called it the existential threat. The Israelis were taken of a sudden, and they were really struck by this operation. The resistance was able to plan with determination and with exactness, and all this kind of enablement to be able to overpower the Israelis on the borders, in the southern borders of Lebanon. And I guess they took the borders for probably 2 hours until the Israelis were in absentia at that time, and the resistance could take these abducted to the safe place. And I guess from that operation till now, the resistance now really fears the Israelis to become very afraid. And new Middle East. Gondaliza Rice came at that time and told the Lebanese, especially Prime Minister Senoura, who was really in a good relation with the Americans, and they met to declare a new era in the Middle East. This resistance could really make this plan futile and make new resistance and new Middle East for the sake of the resistance for the whole region at that time. In terms where in a problem in Baghdad wanted to pick up in Lebanon.
So Saeed Shahabi, let's continue with that train of thought there. When you take a look at what that war meant and all the way up to now, tell us if you can how the resistance has expanded in terms of its fortification, stronger at the base, and able to stand up, not only to stand up against Israel, but also to win it over. The resistance as a whole, for example, the 11-day war against the Palestinian factions, resistance factions out of Gaza, that's another war which goes along that line of the resistance umbrella.
Thank you very much. Definitely, both sides in 2006 wanted that war to be a game changer, change the game. That the Israelis wanted to wipe wipe out Hezbollah and all the kinds of resistance to its occupation. And Hezbollah and its allies wanted also to prove to the world that Israel would no longer be the dominant force in the Middle East and also the or the boss of the region. So I think the betting of by Israel, no, they lost the war. They did not manage to wipe out the resistance. And for the past 15 years, the Israelis have lived with the ramifications inside them that how could we lose this war? And because subsequently they lost the war with Gaza in 2008, 2009. Then they did not win also in 2014. And now, only a few weeks ago, they could not wipe out Hamas, in, which is a small enclave within the occupied territory. So I believe that the Israelis did not win, and that war in 2006, 15 years ago, was a game changer. It changed the whole face of the Middle East, because Israel is no longer the strong power that cannot be defeated.
Thank you very much for that, Mohsen Saleh, academic and lecturer. Thank you, Saeed Shahabi, political activist, journalist, and commentator from London. And with that, we come to an end of this news review.
With that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. Recently, Chief of the United Nations Human Rights Council, Michelle Bachelet, emphasized that countries once involved in the slave trade and slavery, which have since failed to root out demonstrable structural racism, should stop denying it and start dismantling it. We now present you an article authored by Richard Sudan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, Jamaica Will Petition the Queen for Slavery Reparations, and Britain Should Pay Up. Recent weeks, demands for reparations to be distributed to the descendants of African slaves have been growing ever louder, while millions around the world remain increasingly cognizant of the modern-day impacts of systemic anti-black racism, continuing to be a lived reality for those living in countries poisoned by long-lasting and modern legacies of colonialism and slavery. Firstly, Chief of the United Nations Human Rights Council, Michelle Bachelet, off the back of a recent report, emphasized that countries once involved in the slave trade and slavery, which have since failed to root out demonstrable structural racism, should stop denying it and should start dismantling it. Among the 60 or so countries named in the report were the United Kingdom and the United States of America. And although both the United States and the United Kingdom are unlikely to acknowledge such calls, much less act on them, nonetheless, the comments made by Michelle Bachelet reflect an undeniable growing tide of support for what is for many the only real tangible form of restorative justice. But despite this, millions in the United States and the United Kingdom themselves continue to indulge in denialism, false myths, fabrications, and fantasies about real history. Many in the United Kingdom especially often boast about Britain's role in ending the slave trade, when in reality, serious historians have highlighted countless times Britain's leading role in the shameful chapter of the past, and the real motivations behind European powers eventually ceasing to take part in slavery. However, other countries are calling things exactly as they see them. That's why, in addition to the recent United Nations report, many will be applauding the fact that Jamaica's Minister of Culture, Olivia Grange, has suggested that the Jamaican government will soon petition the British Queen for reparations for Jamaica, apparently with the backing and support from Jamaica's political opposition. And it's not a new campaign. For years, Jamaica has been highlighting the need for compensatory justice. Jamaica was once a British colony, and between the mid-1600s and 1840s, it's estimated that more than 3 million Africans were kidnapped as captives and forced into brutal slavery and terrorized. However, the denialism of these facts run deep. When former British Prime Minister David Cameron visited Jamaica in 2015, at the time, the first UK Prime Minister to do so for many years, he avoided questions about reparations, talked about Britain's pride in having apparently ended the slave trade, and suggested that Jamaica move on from the past. Quite apart from the fact that Jamaica, like many other countries, feels the impact of slavery on a number of levels, among David Cameron's own family and descendants were the beneficiaries of the compensation which was paid to slave owners by the government following emancipation. The sum of money borrowed by the government from the Treasury to pay for more than 40,000 slave owners for their loss of property was so large that British taxpayers were continuing to pay the debt up until 2015. According to experts, the loan borrowed by the government to pay slave owners in the British colonies was the equivalent of roughly £20 billion in today's money. The payoff was the biggest in Britain's history until the bailout of the banks during the 2009 financial crash. What this clearly shows is that governments from nations which were built and financed by slavery can dig deep and find money when there is the political will and the desire to do so. Slave owners in the British colonies were compensated for their loss of property, but the slaves themselves did not receive anything. The Queen is head of the Commonwealth and remains the Queen of Jamaica. Jamaica remains deeply in debt to the International Monetary Fund, of which Britain is a member. It is simply not acceptable that this state of affairs continues while Britain still benefits from all of the wealth accumulated through slavery, represented by a royal family symbolizing an empire financed by stolen wealth, remaining one of the richest institutions as the country turns its back on Jamaica while essentially being told to get over slavery. Britain, like the United States of America, has a moral and many would argue a legal obligation to pay what they owe to begin to repair the devastating and ongoing effects of the period of slavery and to make good on their promises and claim to believe in justice. The calls from the world to pay reparations will likely be ignored by Britain and the United States of America, but those calls will only continue to grow louder, and rightly so.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. In this episode, we are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Shavit, is it permissible for a man and his wife to see each other naked or to drive pleasure from each other like this, for example, or to take a shower together and enjoy themselves?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is permissible for a man and his wife to see each other naked and, mm-hmm. of course, to drive all kinds of pleasures from each other and also to take shower together. But Ayatollah Sistani has said, as far as I know, that it is while a person has sexual intercourse, it's not good to look at a wife's private part directly, you know, seeing it. And it is, though it's not haram, you know, but
it's not recommended.
But it's not recommended. It has been discouraged, and it's not good, you know. But if a person does it, he is not sinning. It is still permissible.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see when it comes to taking shower together, of course, it's permissible. Or maybe if a woman wants to her husband to, let's say, to give her a massage, for example, it is permissible. He can or she can look at, both of them can look at each other's body without having to cover themselves. You see, they are husband and wife, actually.
Yes. Okay. So concerning this situation, if the man is not in the mood, for example, to have sexual intercourse with his wife, can he basically use his hands to masturbate his wife or even use external objects to stimulate his wife?
Indeed, this is one of the most frequently asked questions. There are some people who are willing to use external objects, foreign objects, you know, to stimulate or to give pleasure to each other. Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it's not permissible,
mm-hmm.
not permissible to use any such foreign items or external device, you know,
yes.
device to stimulate the wife or the husband. So it's haram, you know. This is the opinion held by Ayatollah Sistani. But when it comes to using one's hand or to using one's body parts, there is no objection. For example, let's say if the wife is not in the mood, you know, to have mm-hmm. sexual intercourse, she can use her hand to stimulate her husband,
mm-hmm.
and the same is the case with the wife. The husband can also do the same thing
mm-hmm.
with his wife, and of course that is absolutely permissible, and there's no objection to them using their hands and their body parts. But as far as the foreign tools or external device is concerned, it's not permissible. There are different device, you know, there are different tools with which they can do this, but and they are found in them on the market, you know,
mm-hmm.
but Muslims cannot use them.
I see. Is it because they are not recommended or impermissible, basically, or haram to use such external objects?
You know, these two terms, impermissible and haram, they are used interchangeably.
Yes.
And when we use impermissible, it means that it gives the same sense. It means that it's haram to use. Haram to use tools and device like mm-hmm. these, you know, like
this.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email. english@sistani.org.
Can a woman in Janaba recite the Holy Quran?
Of course, a woman in Janaba can recite the Holy Quran, and she can recite all parts of the Quran and all surahs of the Quran except for those four verses of the Quran which are haram for her to recite, you know?
The verses of those four chapters or the whole chapters?
Yeah, those four verses according to Ayatollah Sistani, but here we have different scholars with different opinions, you know. Mm-hmm. Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that only those four verses are haram to recite for a woman in menses, for a woman in Janaba, or for a man in Janaba, you know. Mm-hmm. So but there are some Shia scholars who are of the view that it's not permissible to recite even one letter or one verse of the whole chapter. So this is a matter of discrepancy, a matter in which Muslim scholars do not have the same opinion. In other words, Muslim scholars have different opinions in this regard, and there is no consensus about it. As far as other things are concerned, like for example when it comes to entering a mosque or halting in a mosque, pausing in a mosque, touching this the script of the Holy Quran, touching holy names, sacred names are concerned, of course all the scholars are of the view that it is haram for a woman to make her body reach these things, to the script of the Holy Quran or those holy names, you see.
And what about the wall of the mosque? Because we know that the walls of the mosque are built like near the streets. Mm-hmm. So if one touches, like in the state of Janaba, touches, like leans against, for example, the wall of the mosque, is it permissible?
You know, because
again?
The walls, you know, as far as the interior and the interior walls, the exterior wall,
yes,
is concerned, the exterior wall is not a part of the mosque. You know, you can touch it, and it doesn't matter, you know.
No, sometimes the mosques don't have any external or internal walls. They are like the rooms are only like segmented from the street.
Yeah.
With the wall, is like shared between like the outside part of it, the street, the inside is the room of the mosque.
Yeah. What is said about women, about people in Janaba or women in menstruation,
mm-hmm,
goes or refers to the interior or to the inside of the mosque, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A woman in Janaba or in menses is not allowed to enter a mosque and stay there or halt there, but if she enters from one gate, from one door, and goes out of another door without pausing there is no problem. As far as Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi is concerned, of course, it's absolutely forbidden to enter these two mosques because they are the holiest mosques for all Muslims.
What about the shrines of A'imma?
Of course, when it comes to the shrines also, it is not permissible for women to go to that room where the chamber is.
Uh-huh.
The chamber is.
But the yard is not.
The yard is
the
concerned.
The courtyard.
Yeah, as for those parts which are not considered to be mosques, you know, because there are some rooms are considered to be part of a mosque, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you go to Mashhad, you will see there are some parts of the shrine which are considered as mosques. And for women, it's not permissible for women as who are in the state of menstruation or in Janaba to enter those places which are considered as mosques. But as far as the porches are concerned, the corridors are concerned, and the lobbies are concerned, those places which are not part of the mosque and nor part of the room in which the chamber lies,
mm-hmm,
so there is no problem and no objection to women going and walking into these places.
What about the Husainiyas?
The Husainiya, there is no the rules applying to the mosques do not apply to the Husainiyas, and of course women.
And the difference is actually that formula that should be pronounced, like for a mosque,
yes,
to be called a mosque.
Yes. That is the difference, you know. A Husainiya is not considered to be a mosque. It's permissible for women to,
mm-hmm,
go there, to sit there, and to engage in dua. and supplications, even when in they are in the state of Janaba.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Full Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Rumsfeld never had much understanding of Iraq or Afghanistan, and probably did not think that he had any need to do so, says Patrick Cockburn Ryder in an article published under the heading, Rumsfeld was living symbol of America's plunge into quagmire. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As U.S. War Secretary between 2001 and 2006, Rumsfeld gloried in his role as America's military chief, avenging 9/11. But his arrogance and inability to adjust to the realities of the Afghan and Iraq wars produced frustration or failure on the battlefield. Maneuver, though, Rumsfeld did to avoid responsibility for the Iraq war. He became the living symbol of America's plunge into the quagmire. typically, he responded to this by banning his staff at the Pentagon from using the word quagmire along with resistance and insurgents. Rumsfeld started his career as a Republican congressman from Illinois and moved on to serve four Republican presidents. He headed the Office for Economic Opportunity under Nixon, became War Secretary and Ambassador to NATO in the Ford administration. As President Ronald Reagan's special envoy to the West Asia North Africa region, he traveled to Baghdad to shake hands with Saddam Hussein and assure him of U.S. support in the eight-year war that the Iraqi dictator had imposed against Iran. Rumsfeld's camaraderie with Saddam reflected American strategy at the time, but it also showed Rumsfeld's liking for people with power and his dismissiveness towards those without it. It was Iraq that turned out to be his nemesis. He promoted his public image as a man who did not blench when Al-Qaeda flew a plane into the Pentagon on 9/11. He had personally rushed to succor survivors, though witnesses later said stories of his heroism were exaggerated. By that evening, he was giving a press conference from a bunker in the Pentagon, demonstrating that though President George W. Bush might have been evacuated to safety, his war secretary was standing tall. Within hours of the Al-Qaeda attack, Rumsfeld was looking to use it as justification for a war against Iraq. He sent a note to General Richard Myers, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, looking for best info fast, judge whether good enough to hit Saddam Hussein, at the same time, not only Osama bin Laden. This detail, along with much else in this piece, is derived from Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy by Andrew Cockburn. Rumsfeld sought in his memoir to evade responsibility for launching the Iraq War, claiming that President Bush had never asked him if he was in favor of it. The excuse is absurd, since the war secretary had constant one-on-one meetings with Bush, who might well assume that the man in charge of gathering America's armies for the invasion was in favor of doing so. Rumsfeld enjoyed flying around the world in his giant C-17 transport plane, addressing assemblies of U.S. troops, but he was essentially a palace politician. Not only did he have access to the Oval Office himself, but he fought determined campaigns to exclude other top officials from meetings with the president. He was even upset when Jerry Bremer, the newly appointed U.S. Viceroy in Iraq, had a private lunch with Bush in May 2003. Rumsfeld never had much understanding of Iraq or Afghanistan and probably did not think that he had any need to do so because the military might of the U.S. appeared overwhelming. Rumsfeld reacted furiously when the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Eric Shinseki, told a Senate hearing that several hundred thousand troops might be needed as an occupation force after the invasion. Rumsfeld's pretense that he did not favor the Iraqi war is easily disproved, but a better line of defense from his point of view was that almost no members of America's political military elite were opposed to the war at the time. Critics countered this by saying that military officers whose promotion was in the hands of Rumsfeld were unlikely to express skepticism about his plans. Rumsfeld produced a much-quoted but fallacious explanation. which was used to explain why the U.S. was so often caught by surprise by disastrous events in Iraq. He said that some facts were known and others unknown facts, but there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. Rumsfeld said this in 2002 in relation to the shortage of evidence for the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and it briefly won him a reputation for intellectual brilliance, but it masked the damning fact that there were no knowns about Iraq that were good reasons for believing that a regime change would lead to a prolonged military and political crisis. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. As we mentioned previously, the concept of Salah, the prayers, especially the five daily prayers, which is a means for an individual to attain, to acquire, to establish a connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is very beautiful if you actually think about it, that we believe, we can believe intellectually that there is a God, there is a creator, there is what we call the essential existence, the wajib al-wujud. But by our intellect, we will not be able to understand, okay, how do I now create a connection with it? I know it's there. I know I have to find a way to create a connection. But if you honestly had to think about it for however long you feel like it, you will never be able to come up with a concept, with a means like the Salah. And therefore we see that the Salah has obviously secrets within it that some of the great scholars have kind of expounded on in their books. So the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam regarding this said that one who adheres to the five daily prayers diligently. So this is now obviously a person not half-heartedly, you know, sometimes prays, sometimes doesn't pray, some days he feels he needs a holiday and so on. No, he adheres to the praying of these five prayers. Again, as we mentioned, the differences in the schools of jurisprudence, but that's not the issue right now. That these prayers, so the person who does it diligently, adheres to them, these prayers shall be a means of illumination and salvation for him on the day of judgment. So from this tradition, we can come and we can conclude, obviously, in terms of, you know, a kind of supposed nature. Obviously, we don't know 100% if this would be, but we can kind of, you know, presume that one of the ways a person will be known on that day is by his prayer. Because if the prayer grants him illumination, a person will see that this person is illuminated. And he will know that, oh, this is one of the musalleen, one of those who prayed and the true prayers towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And only that he will attain salvation, and that he will then be of those who are granted a good place with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the hereafter. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us of those who truly pray diligently, adhere to the prayer, adhere to the laws of prayer, adhere to the physical nature of the prayer, of the salah, so that we may be illuminated both in this world and in the hereafter, inshaAllah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kabit Akhwai. Stop the abuse of international law, the use of force or the threat of force to stop making provocations in the South China Sea. Well, the list is rather long. That is what China has accused the U.S. of. And the two have had another encounter. China's military says that it chased a U.S. warship out of a disputed area of the South China Sea after Washington warned an attack on the Philippines might activate a mutual defense treaty. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will review all the areas where